ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
My name's Corbin Middlemass. This is Grandstand at Lunch. The voice of summer, Jim Maxwell's alongside me. Hello, Jim.
Corbin, how are you going? We're having a bit of a history chat here from the look of it, which is very nice. There's so much history about this place.
No one's read more than you, Jim, so I can't wait to have this conversation, and you chime in wherever you like and help us along the way to fill in
a
few of the blanks. From the Telegraph, the chief cricket correspondent is Nick Holt, and I'm pleased to say he joins us on Grandstand at Lunch on ABC Sport. Nick, appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
And Harold Larwood's grandson, Andrew McGrath, is here to have a chat with us as well. Andrew, thanks for jumping on.
Not a problem.
I think we should start right at the top. So first of all, Nick, set this up for us. For people that aren't aware and perhaps not as much of a historian of the game as others, who was Harold Larwood?
So Harold Larwood was a fast bowler for England in the 1920s and 1930s, who was the man who implemented bodyline, which I believe Australia still haven't recovered from all these years later. We have to take our wins where we get them in Australia, so of course we still celebrate Harold and all his achievements. And after his career, he didn't play again, actually, after the bodyline series. His last match was here at the SCG. He scored 98 in his last innings. He walked off here for the final time. Later in life, he moved to Australia, set up his life here. And he moved here with the help of some of his Australian opponents in the bodyline series. And loved the second half of his life living in Australia, where he brought up his five daughters, one of which, Mary, is Andrew's mother. For many years, I'd wanted to track down the Larwood family on an Ashes tour. Particularly, I wanted to see the ashtray that was a gift from Douglas Jardine, being our captain, the bodyline series to Harold, which I think is probably one of the most unique pieces of cricketing memorabilia in the world. And this was the tour that I managed to do it with the help of Andrew here.
That is a beautiful setup. That's exactly what we're hoping to get as a way to start us off. So, Andrew, that brings you into the conversation. All of a sudden, with one of the world's best cricket journalists, all of a sudden gets in contact with you. What were you thinking, and how did that phone call first come about?
I suppose a little bit taken aback. It's all very, for me, it's all very humbling. I was more than happy to have a conversation. Very proud of my grandfather.
What did you know about him? So take us back, I guess, to your earliest family education, family history.
My mum and I ended up living with my grandparents from probably about four until he passed away in 95. So my whole life, till early 20s. So I suppose talking to my friends growing up, they were probably more interested, you know, if I told them that I'd seen Richard Hadley in the backyard or someone like that, as opposed to, you know, Colin Cowdery or, you know, Celine Hutton. It was a little bit split in that regard. My earliest memory I told Nick was Chris Old. I visited and he had these huge feet, and I was only probably about four, five, six, and it just stuck in my mind.
That's awesome. Andrew McGrath, Harold Larwood's grandson and also chief cricket correspondent from the Telegraph, Nick Holt, with us on ABC Sport during the lunch break. Jim, the amount of time in your life that you've spent reading and researching cricket, I imagine a fair portion of that would have been dedicated towards the bodyline series?
To be honest, my father probably told me more about it than I read, because there was a very famous match in that series earlier on when Stan McCabe took the bowling on, right? And he got away with it. He's a bit like Brook, I think. He had one of those days where every time he hit it in the air, it landed safely. But he made 180-odd here. And a lot of people thought at the time, well, that's the end of bodyline. McCabe's just killed it. But that wasn't quite the case, as it turned out. It was just one of those bits of blue sky and a storm, as it turned out. But that's my memory of it. Other than having met your grandfather here in 1970-71. I won't go into too much detail about why I was in the England dressing room, but there I was waiting for Geoffrey Boycott to sell off all his clobber, but that's another story too. And Harold was there. waiting for the moment that England won the Ashes, because, as you know, they don't win the Ashes here very often, four times since the war, and certainly not this one. But, yeah, he was a quiet fellow, wasn't he? Didn't say a lot.
Very humble.
Yeah.
Very, very lovely
man.
Yep. Oh, thank you.
He liked a fag?
He did.
Yes,
he did.
That's why we've got the ashtray. Now, but I saw you at the Cricket Tana, the Cricket Collectors show down at Burrowing.
Yes.
Yeah. So you're a collector, not just of ashtrays.
I am. I am a big book collector.
Okay.
And
Cricket books?
Pardon?
Cricket
books. Of course, yes. Mm. But I made it a bit of a mission to go after as many cigarette cards as I could of my grandfather. So I've done that, and I've framed a few, and yeah.
Right. So you're holding on to them all. Have you worked out, I always ask this of collectors, what you're going to do with them? Because most collectors don't want it just to disappear because young Johnny doesn't want it and have it all flogged off and go into smoke.
I think my son and my daughter will carry it on. So.
Excellent.
Yeah, pretty sure.
Were you a cricketer?
Not yes, but...
McGrath, that's a name.
It's a little bit ironic, isn't it?
Did you speak to your grandfather much about cricket?
Again, yeah, growing up, yes. Stories, you know, every day, and they were just stories. He could tell a really good story, and you know, some of it was probably lost on me at times, but yeah, it was always a conversation.
Nick, what did you learn? You've written a piece about the Larwood family. What did you learn on this trip that perhaps you didn't know previously?
Oh, so much about the history of family. Certainly the sort of second half of Harold's life living in Australia. We had an afternoon here. I flew down from Brisbane to meet Andrew and his mother Mary, and your cousin Janet. We were at her house, which isn't far from here, and that's where they had the ashtray. I tried not to look too excited as they got it out. And I remember one thing that stuck with me was your mum talking about... her mother, your grandmother, and the sort of slight concern that the animosity towards Harold running the Bodyline series would still be a case when they made their life here. Mm. And she said that your grandmother would take the shoes to the cobbler to be mended and leave a different surname. She didn't want to say it was Mrs. Larwood in case it caused some sort of backlash all those years later. But I think it's one of the great things about Australian society that he was embraced here and made a very happy
so life. For a series that caused, you know, so much consternation, to then pick Australia as of all countries to come out and play in these parts, did you get many reports of that as to what it was like in the early years when he tried to, I guess, just settle into civilian life after such a controversial series?
Yeah, I don't think he had too much trouble. I mean, Bert Oldfield was probably one, he probably classed him as his closest friend. Jack Fingleton was another one who encouraged him to sort of come out. A lot of the Australians were very welcoming and very helpful. And again, going back to his humbleness, he didn't want to use his name. He never traded on his name. He was just he just wanted to live his life quietly. But that didn't always happen. People would knock on the door and phone calls. He was very welcoming.
I think one of the favourite stories was that Mary Toll was meeting the bumping into Donald Bradman in Sydney city centre. So Mary, I think she was about 14, 15.
Yeah, it wasn't long after we're here. Yeah.
And she was going into town to buy her father was buying her a present, and he said, "Look who's coming in the other way." And it was the first time the two men had met for many years. It was the Don, and of course they're just meeting in the middle of the street. Nobody recognised them. Two men who were at the centre of an almost diplomatic incident. Yeah. Bodyline series. So.
Interesting though that did he ever say much about his departure, demise as an English cricketer? Because he seemed to be treated pretty harshly, as Nick said. He didn't play again after Bodyline.
Again, maybe it's the generation. He never had a bad word to say. Always very respectful. Referred to when telling a story, captains were Mr. Jardine, Mr. Carr. So no, there was never really any animosity to the establishment, for want of a better word. There probably was.
I think Australians felt more kindly to him than the English did.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons he came here. He felt as though the were more friends down under than at home.
Yeah, 100%. And I think he also, I know he said that he saw more opportunity in Australia for a young family, considering, I suppose, there was still rationing from the war in England, and yeah, just a better life and friends, welcoming friends.
Something happened though. One of the daughters married a bloke who played first grade for St George, I think.
Yeah, my Auntie Frieda.
Yeah, what was his name?
Roger. My Uncle Roger. Roger Bashford.
Bashford, that was it. Roger Bashford.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So there you go.
There you go.
Is there any more history of that fast bowling blood, DNA?
Not yet.
Not yet. It's coming.
Not yet.
So many famous cricketers stopped by the house when you were growing up?
Yeah, probably too many to remember, but I can distinctly remember we had an outside toilet, and I was a teenager, and I've sort of walked out the backyard to, as you do, you know, in the morning, and Richard Hadley was out there having a chat. Darren Goff, Graham Gooch, Colin Cowdery, Sir Len Hutton offered to put me up if I ever came to England, but unfortunately he passed away before I ever got there or got to an age to go. Too many.
Alan Davidson was there.
Yeah, or Alan Davidson and Betty Davidson were great friends of my grandparents. Yes. Yeah. When I was growing up, used to come to the cricket, and I'd sort of be up at the back of the ladies' stand with Betty Davidson and others. And yeah, again, it was a big family almost. Mm-hmm. So yeah.
If you love your cricket, Nick, and a lot of people that obviously listen to Grandstand Cricket here on the ABC do, but a lot of our newer audiences perhaps aren't as familiar with the history of the game. How significant an event was the Bodyline Series in terms of changing cricket forever?
Well, just one word sums up a series, and I struggle to think of another series where that has happened. So Bodyline takes you instantly to that one test series. That is unique. People like me are still knocking on Larwood's door 90-odd years later, interested in the story. Ashes cricket is built on its history. These guys stand on the shoulders of Harold Larwood, Douglas Jardine, Stan McCabe, and I hope that they recognise that. I think they do. Because without that history, would there be 50,000 here on day four of a test match? I'm not so sure. That's how important I think it is.
Is there been a more significant chapter in the game than that series, Jim?
Probably not, no. Because it could have well split Australia and England as it did at the time, with the various telegrams going hither and thither about, you know, one country's playing cricket out there, the other's not, that sort of stuff from Woodville. So, yes, it was heightened. And also by... Have you been down there to look at the sculpture of Yabba?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, he's very famous with his stentorian voice as a barracker. They reckon you could hear him down the street. And, you know, the famous line with Jardine is he's standing there doing that to the flies, and his voice comes up from the hill. Jardine, leave our flies alone!
And he's immortalised in bronze nowadays, yes. Yabba. He's got a seat in the front row at underneath the Trumper stand. So if the ground's empty, you can still see the statue, and obviously stands out pretty prominently any day of the week when the ground is vacant. Nick Holt, the chief correspondent from The Telegraph, with us on Grandstand at lunch, alongside Andrew McGrath, Harold Larwood's grandson. Of course, the voice of summer, Jim Maxwell, and myself, Corbin Middlemass, with England 1 for 80, trailing by 103. As much as we got you here to talk about the Larwood family and your brilliant piece, which you can obviously catch up on in The Telegraph, I've got to ask you about this current version of the England team, Nick.
Where's Larwood? Where is he?
Well, he certainly wasn't running in yesterday with a new ball, was he, when Matthew Potts was bowling?
So, series is just about done. How should England cricket fans feel about what they've seen down here and across these five test matches?
Well, they should feel empty, very disappointed, and feel let down. This was their chance. This was a series where Australia were there for the taking, comparative to previous tours we've had here in recent years. They had a set method of playing. They had a settled team, far more settled team before Perth than the Australians did. And they threw it away in one afternoon. And I think some of those guys will regret that for the rest of their careers, probably longer. Inevitably, if they lose here 4-1, and it... I suspect that it'll lead to change somehow, somewhere. You can't come here with such hope, lose 4-1, and everybody be patted on the back and say, carry on. So I'm sure there'll be change. I'm trying to think of a player who's just, well, Joe Root's 200s, but
Josh Tung?
Struggling. Josh Tung's bowled really well and probably extended his... Jacob Bethel, who knows what he could do this afternoon. He is a special talent, but they underprepared. They lacked professionalism, and it's bitten them badly.
Last one before you guys jump out of here, Andrew. You supporting England or are you supporting Australia now as an Aussie that's lived here your whole life?
Australia. Of course.
Here we go.
Were you a fast bowler?
Not fast, but tried.
That's important.
Thanks heaps for coming in. Nick, thanks for telling such an important story and an integral part, not just of cricket history, but of Ashes history as well. Appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew. Andrew McGrath and Nick Holt, our guests during the lunch break. And thanks to the voice of Summer, Jim Maxwell as well. This is Grandstand at Lunch. The story of Harold Larwood, of course, a central part of the Bodyline series all those years ago. And always great to catch up with Nick, who's one of the world's best cricket writers, the chief cricket correspondent with The Telegraph. It is Grandstand at Lunch, day four of the fifth test in Sydney, and England trying to get to 183 just to make the Aussies bat for a second time in the test. The tourists are currently 1 for 80, and they trail by 103 runs. All right, Darren Lehman is alongside me as we count down towards the start of the second session on day four, which will take you to the ABC newsroom, and then the first ball after lunch will be coming up in about 15 minutes from now. Before then, Buff, a look ahead to the next major point on the calendar for not just the Australian cricket team, but also their opponents in England and the rest of the world. So in February and March, the cricketing world will move to the subcontinent, played across Sri Lanka and India, a 20-team tournament to decide our World Cup holders in the T20 format of the game for 2026. The Australians have announced their squad, which I'm keen to pick apart, but as an overall, I guess, gambit from you, how significant is a World Cup when it comes around, regardless of the format?
Oh, very significant. It's I still don't think it's as prestigious as the One Day World Cup. I mean, that's got so much history attached to it. The T20 will get there over a period of time.
Is it also because of its frequency? So every 2 years for the T20s, yeah, as opposed to 4 years for the 50 over?
I would like to see it stretched to four, just for that reason. So then you get that real eagerness of the World Cup. But every 2 years goes, 2 years' time, we'll have another one.
Yeah.
The Olympics is 4 years. Everything else is a four-year cycle. So I think they can change that, the T20 format, back to a four-year cycle. I would like to see that. The current players love it. You know, it's here. Current teams love it. But does it have the mystique of the 50-over World Cup? Not as yet.
So Australia are in a group which includes Sri Lanka, Zimbabwe, Ireland and Oman, who we haven't played a whole lot of cricket against, it must be said. So Sri Lanka, Zimbabwe, Ireland and Oman.
Not a tough group, Corbin.
No. So the group stage basically is all played in Sri Lanka, and then the Aussies will move to India for the remainder of the tournament thereafter. The way that this tournament is set up, which is a little bit weird, they have pre-seeds. So basically the Aussies carry in a seeding, like a ranked number, and basically they've predetermined what the groups will look like if the results go the favoured way. So let's just say, for argument's sake, that all the top seeds make it out of their group and the position that we expect them to. One side will be England, New Zealand, Pakistan and Sri Lanka. And on the other side, the Aussies will be in the Super 8s with India, the West Indies and South Africa. So although you think, oh, India, that's tough, there's two that gets through from each of those groups. So in a way, you'd almost rather be ranked with India there, because it means you won't play them again until a potential final. Now, I've named what I think the Aussie 11 will look like. I'll get you to disagree, yep, with me based off the 15 players that have been chosen. But Marsh and Head,
yep,
sensational opening combination. Cam Green, Josh Inglis, Tim David, Marcus Stoinis, Glenn Maxwell. And then the bowlers, Cummins, Hazelwood, Ellis as the three quicks, and Adam Zampa as the spinner. So if that's the way the Aussies go, there'll be four players in the squad that don't get a look in my initial 11, for whatever that's, yep, worth. Cooper Conley,
yep,
Matt Short,
yep,
Xavier Bartlett and Matt Cunneman. Am I missing anyone that you would take out of the reserves and try and put into the first choice 11?
No, it's the easiest selection ever.
Day 17 of working together. We've got a consensus.
Is new starting? That's how quick this segment's gone. Because we are together. That's exactly what I had. There's talk about Maxwell not playing.
Yep.
You're playing him in the subcontinent. The only danger in the top group, the first group, is Sri Lanka. At home, they can be,
yeah,
you know, hot and cold. It might be a little bit, but everyone else will beat. And then if it carries on from there, it'll be fine. They won't change much because Maxwell gives them the extra spin. Inglis has been very good. They've got enough all-rounders in Green and Stoinis. Marsh head at the top. Cummins Hazelwood have been excellent. Ellis, everything's covered there. And if the backup's covered as well. You've got your opener in short if you need. Connolly can fill in if one of the quicks and you want it spinning square. Same with Kuhneman. You can throw him in there if you don't need all the quicks. And Bartlett can take the new ball. So that's a really good squad that Australia selected. The selection panel have done a really good job.
I agree.
With that 15.
I genuinely think, I can't remember a time where the T20 teams looked better, even when they won it. Remembering when they won the tournament, they were rank outsiders and proved everyone wrong the whole way through. But I sneaky think like that almost be my pre-tournament pick. It's clearly going to be them and India, isn't it, as the two teams to watch.
I've got Australia as one.
Yeah, I'm with you.
I just love the way they play. I think they've got it. You know, if they only need Head or Marsh to have a good tournament, and they'll go a long way. Because they destroy attacks quickly.
Yeah.
I mean, they ruin games quickly. We're talking about two guys that can actually ruin a game in the space of a power play or 10 overs, the game's done and dusted. So if they have a good series, if they don't, I mean, Marsh and Head, it brings them back to the pack a little bit.
Yeah.
That's all. But their hitting power is unbelievable. David, I mean, as long as injuries, and that by the sounds of the stuff we're getting through, they're going to be right on track and they're going to play, so we're going to be okay.
Change is still permitted until January 31. The first Australian game is against Ireland on February 11. So no Mitch Owen. He was a notable omission. And Mitchell Starc's retired from T20 international cricket. No Johnson, who's barely played. Dorshus, Abbott, Hardy, all overlooked. No Carey, no Phillippe. But I imagine one of the keepers, probably Alex Carey, you think will travel as a travelling emergency. And he'll only come into the official 15-man squad in case of injury.
And if it's only one game or two games, isn't Glenn Maxwell practising his keeping? Or something?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're doing that sort of stuff. A bit like strikers are doing with, what's his name?
A bit like Jimmy Marr back in the day.
Jimmy, no, don't talk about Jimmy Marr, my great mate. I told that story early on the year, but that's still the most, Ricky Ponting didn't talk to us for a week and a half because he was doing the wrong thing by me when I was running into bowl.
Cricket's 10 minutes away. Darren Lehman will be back then. This is Grandstand Cricket on ABC Sport.